Chapter 10. The best place in the world to be a woman? Woman. When all has been said, when the problems of the world have been weighed, gauged, and settled, when eyes have met and hands been pressed in the sobriety of the moment, some woman always comes to clear the table, sweep the floor, and open the windows to let out the cigar smoke. It never fails. Icelandic poet Ingeborg Haraldsdottir. I crane my neck up toward the top of the monolith in front of me. Inside a tall glass cylinder rising up from the floor, suspended in clear fluid, is what must be the world's largest penis. Erect and standing on end, it's taller than I am. I glance to my left and then to my right. Everywhere I look, there are more of them. Huge ones, medium-sized ones, tiny ones, hung from the walls, hanging from the ceiling, and sprouting from the floor. It's a forest of phalluses. I shake my head, bewildered. Is this a hallucination? A delusion born of jet lag? No, it's Iceland. I'm in what is billed the world's only penis museum. It boasts 285 specimens from the massive sperm whale member in front of me down to tiny hamster and field mouse appendages. There are ancient carved phalluses behind glass, lampshades and bow ties made out of whale foreskins, and letters hanging on the wall from men who have proudly pledged their organs to the museum after they die. One case prominently displays silver casts of more than a dozen human penises, with a photo above that helpfully identifies their owners. The Icelandic national handball team pictured in uniform, thankfully, after winning the silver medal in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Perhaps it's fitting that this museum is in the heart of Reykjavik, the country's capital. Iceland remains one of the most masculine cultures in the world. This is a country that takes its Viking roots seriously. From the axes in the souvenir shops to the statue of explorer Leif Erikson standing guard over the brazenly phallic tower of the Church of Iceland. On the way in from the airport, I had been mesmerized by the harsh landscape of pocked black rock stretching for miles beyond the bus window. It turns out Iceland's terrain of volcanoes and geysers is so rugged, so otherworldly, that Neil Armstrong and his fellow Apollo astronauts trained here before walking on the moon. The people I meet here are at least as tough. I'd found myself in the museum, officially the Icelandic Phallological Museum, only after ducking in to escape the freezing rain and gusting winds. The Icelanders strolling the streets didn't seem to notice. No one carried an umbrella, an accessory that is apparently a mark of humiliating weakness. The pleasant young clerk at the hotel front desk had shooed me outside half an hour earlier, assuring me, without irony, it's a beautiful day for a walk. Yet, I'm here because Iceland, by some measure, is the best place in the world to be a woman. For 8 consecutive years, the World Economic Forum has ranked it the number one country on the planet for gender equality. That puts it ahead of 144 other countries, including the U.S., which came in a disappointing 45th, well behind Rwanda and Burundi. Iceland's men are famously supportive of feminism. When the United Nations introduced an initiative called He for She in 2014 to enlist men to support women's equality, Icelandic men trumped those of every other nation. 1 in 20 of them, some 35,000, signed on, a percentage that, if replicated in the U.S., would work out to about 16 million men. I had to travel here to understand why. How did this tiny island nation figure out how to solve a problem that has bedeviled the rest of the world for centuries? Are Icelandic men different than men everywhere else? What secrets might they impart? Most of all, I wanted to know, what does true gender equality feel like? The curious thing about this number one ranking, I couldn't help but notice, was the speed with which it happened. Iceland and other Nordic countries have long clustered in the upper reaches of such lists. But Iceland leapfrogged over the others quite quickly to claim the top spot. Perhaps, I thought, it could show the rest of the world how to transform a culture, and to do so swiftly. Maybe it had finally cracked the code of how the rest of us can make great strides to close the gender gap, too. After all, Iceland had begun its race to the top of the gender equality rankings only after 2008. It turns out that date was no accident. In September 2008, the world economy crashed. The meltdown was the worst since the Great Depression. In the U.S., the stock market plunged. The banking system was forced to its knees. People's retirement savings were wiped out, their jobs lost, and their homes suddenly worth less than the mortgage that they could no longer afford to pay anyway. But if there was anything that could make Americans feel a tiny bit better about the crisis at home, it was the thought that, hey, at least we weren't Iceland. Because in Iceland, the damage was far worse. No country crashed harder than Iceland after the crisis. That's because no country behaved so insanely before it. Convinced that they could do anything Wall Street financiers could do, a nation of fishermen and sheep farmers became international bankers and currency traders. Business Vikings, they were called with pride. They donned bespoke suits from London, collected gorgeous girlfriends who wore furs and jewels instead of snow boots and parkas, and plowed their Range Rovers, once a rarity in this land of humble, compact cars, through Reykjavik's narrow streets. They were virtually all men, young men. They were all heroes in the eyes of the Icelandic people. We had the geniuses that were conquering the world. John Steinar Gudlaugsson, who was a Supreme Court justice during the boom years, told me, when I visited him in his modest post-crash law office near the waterfront, he sounded almost wistful. Maybe one of the reasons for this tragedy in the Icelandic economy was those guys were too much tough guys. When Icelanders talk about the boom years, you encounter that kind of muscular imagery a lot. Conquerors, Vikings, marauders. The banking system was like a Viking ship, as a government report described it. Icelanders are risk takers. They are daring and aggressive, the country's president, Olafur Ragnar Grimson, proudly told an audience at London's Tony Walbrook Dining Club in 2005. It was a message he repeated in countless talks from Wall Street to London to Asia to the World Economic Forum meetings in Davos. Like Vikings on the high seas, Iceland's bankers were young, energetic, quick decision makers and ruthless, conquering everything in their paths. What's more, the bankers not only threw cash around themselves, they lavished it on others, handing out bank loans to almost anyone who asked. The rise of these new Vikings lifted all boats. Quite literally. Back at my hotel, after a rain-swept trot from the Phallological Museum, I met Gunnar Sigurdsson, a grizzled 56-year-old with an impish smile and a wicked sense of humor. He, like most men I meet here, is a fisherman. Or I should say, was a fisherman. When the banking boom erupted, he was able to pursue his real dream, to become a theater director. He borrowed money and funded a theater company. He borrowed more money and bought a two-bedroom flat in a good neighborhood. He leased a Nissan sedan. He took out his loans in euros and yen, like other Icelanders. The theory was that the value of the Icelandic krona was rising so fast that it was cheaper and smarter to pay off debt pegged to other, less vaunted currencies. If you were to look at a chart of Iceland's national debt from 2001 to 2008, you would see a pretty much vertical line shooting straight up. Gunnar may not have realized it, but his good fortune was the result of a regulation change in 2003 when Iceland privatized its three state-owned banks. Before then, bankers made a tidy but unremarkable living lending to local fishermen, sheep farmers, and the people who sold Icelandic sweaters to tourists. They knew their customers personally. After all, most of them were relatives. Iceland is home to only about 320,000 people. It's so homogeneous that scientists famously use it as a petri dish for genetic research. We owe pretty much everything we know about Alzheimer's genes and genome sequencing to experiments done on Icelanders. So many of them are related that there's an app that tells young Icelanders whether the person they're about to hook up with is a cousin. Before the boom years, Iceland had enjoyed years of peace and, if not exactly prosperity, at least general, congenial comfort. Its citizens are among the most educated in the world, and its healthcare system is strong. Its paid parental leave policy is extravagantly generous, spanning 9 months. It hasn't seen war in centuries and doesn't field an army. Like other Nordic countries, it's as close to socialism as you can get in the modern world. When I landed at the Reykjavik airport, I noticed that the first-class travelers were herded into the same lines as the rest of us, as if Icelanders want to make sure these rich folks don't get too full of themselves. But all that changed after the banks were privatized. The country erupted in a frenzy of international financial chest-thumping. Suddenly, the newly private banks could do business with anyone, anywhere. Then Prime Minister David Otsen spun visions of international domination. A poet and one-time mayor of Reykjavik, he had become besotted with his free market heroes Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. He lowered taxes and freed up trade. Icelandic inflation was soaring, a quirk of the country's massive investment in aluminum smelting, and the country's interest rates were high, shooting well into the double digits by 2007. When the newly privatized banks opened their doors to the outside world, foreign money flooded in. Looking to make an easy 14% a year, the banks were suddenly floating in cash. For Gunnar, the timing couldn't have been better. He had spent years scrambling to make a living in a variety of jobs, from fishing to owning a shop that sold videotapes and ice cream. Now, for the first time, he didn't have to worry about money. It was easy to get his hands on cash. Not only was he earning his keep as a local theater director, he was dreaming up far grander ambitions. Like the bankers, he set his sights on international expansion. He wrote a play and rented a theater in London. Then he set about rehearsing his actors to prepare for his international debut. His plans seemed modest compared to those of some of his friends. In the U.S., the stock market doubled from 2003 to 2007. In Iceland, it didn't double or even triple. It multiplied by 9 times. Iceland, once known for its equitable income distribution, suddenly had a class of people who were unspeakably, ostentatiously, unimaginably, filthy rich. The owner of a shipping company converted one of his warehouses into a giant party space and hired Elton John to perform for his birthday. A retail magnate named Jan Ajir Johansson bought a 145-foot yacht and a 25-million Manhattan penthouse apartment, though he was later sued by potential buyers for equipping it with a cheap IKEA kitchen. A bank CEO, Loris Welding, was so frustrated with bankers demanding he triple their salaries that he told them, "Just stop buying yourselves Porsches and drinking so much booze, and you will feel much better. Stop changing wives, and it will save you a lot of money." Iceland's bankers were giddy over this endless geyser of cash and oblivious to signs that they were in the midst of one of the biggest financial bubbles the world had ever seen. In fact, the Icelandic economy was on the brink. By late 2007, there were whispers that the bubble was about to pop. International bankers, regulators, and journalists began asking questions. Around the world, a sense of alarm, impending disaster, was growing. But back in Reykjavik, Gunnar, the fisherman turned director, didn't worry himself over the rumblings. He trusted Iceland's politicians, who shrugged them off as nonsense. A banker friend publicly dismissed the concerns as an image problem that could be solved with a PR campaign. Gunnar figured his friends and his country's leaders knew better than those naysaying foreigners, who probably were just jealous of Iceland's success. Besides, he was too busy rehearsing his actors for their London premiere. He had poured his savings into rehearsal space to go along with the theater rental. All was proceeding just as he had planned. "I thought everything was going well," as he recalls. "The financial geniuses had everything under control, and the ones saying otherwise were just morons and idiots." The morons and idiots, of course, turned out to be right. Gunnar's play was scheduled to premiere on October 8, 2008. As it turned out, that instead was the day Iceland's banks failed. None could withstand the international panic that had followed the collapse a few weeks earlier of Lehman Brothers in the United States. Chaos reigned. Iceland, the little country that could, suddenly became the ridiculous wannabe that couldn't. The rest of the world had decided that Iceland, unlike, say, Goldman Sachs, wasn't too big to fail, and fail it did, spectacularly. Iceland was effectively bankrupt. In Reykjavik, Gunnar watched events unfold with growing dread. Desperately, he began reaching out to his backers in London. They stopped returning his phone calls. All of his grand plans, everything he'd been working for his entire life, evaporated before his astonished eyes. Dread turned to panic, and for good reason. In the aftermath of the collapse, the krona crashed. The loans Gunnar had taken out in euros, he had to pay back in now worthless Icelandic currency. Payments suddenly tripled. He turned in the keys to his car. He stopped paying his mortgage. Gunnar's play would never open, shattering his dreams of international acclaim. He would lose every cent of his investment. Some of his neighbors had it even worse. One infuriated Icelander, his home now owned by the bank, was so angry he bulldozed the place. Newspaper classified ads offered cars for negative prices. The owners would pay someone to take the vehicle off their hands. One joker listed Iceland for sale on eBay, Icelandic singer Björk not included. Starting bid, 99 pence. In the fall of 2008, when it all came crashing down, Iceland's citizens, a generally pacifist lot, erupted in fury against stupid thinking. Crowds tumbled out on the streets. Gunnar, his savings gone, his dreams for his theater dashed, his car repossessed, joined the protesters. The mob demanded that the government resign. To be sure, the demonstrations were carried out in thoroughly Icelandic fashion. Law-abiding protesters pushed double strollers, and at their most agitated, threw oranges and bananas. A typical chant went like this: do we want new ways of ruling? Yes. Do we want to abolish corruption? Yes. Do we want peaceful demonstrations? Yes. It was around this time that one of the country's few female bankers heard an insistent knocking on her door. Hers was the only bank in the country that had avoided the crazy risks and that was still solvent, thanks to, in her business partner's words, bringing greater female values into the financial world. She padded to the door and opened it to find an old man. "I just want some women to take care of my money," he said, as recounted by writer Michael Lewis in his engaging take on the crisis and Boomerang Travels and the New Third World. As Lewis observed, one of the distinctive traits about Iceland's disaster and Wall Street's is how little women had to do with it. Among financial journalists, the gallows humor joke was that there wouldn't have been a crisis if we had Lehman sisters instead of Lehman brothers. And it's true. As Lewis noted, the U.S. and Iceland had that in common. Women had virtually nothing to do with the disastrous financial bets in either country. What's more notable, though, is how each country responded. In the U.S., the men who crashed the economy remained at their posts. In Iceland, the men were sent to jail. Women replaced them. Two of Iceland's three banks named women as their new presidents. The entire Icelandic government resigned, right up to the prime minister, the swashbuckling cheerleader of the business Vikings. He, too, was replaced by a woman, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir, the first openly lesbian leader of any country in history. The head of Iceland's Chamber of Commerce, also a woman, spoke for many when she derided the man-made crisis as a penis competition among bankers. It was an extraordinary phenomenon. It's as if an entire population rose up, unified with a single objective, to flush the testosterone out of its system. It flew in the face of thousands of years of history, turning upside down a culture that had always celebrated its bloodthirsty Viking heritage. The women's takeover was a spectacle the world had never seen. In the UK, The Guardian heralded the move, "After the crash, Iceland's women lead the rescue." The Financial Times declared, "Iceland calls in women bankers to clean up young men's mess." In New Zealand, the NZ Herald crowed, "Viking women fight to save nation in meltdown," while perhaps most pointedly, PBS announced, "Viking women aim to end Iceland's age of testosterone." Indeed, Johanna's new government called for bringing in a bucket full of estrogen to the male-dominated worlds of business and finance. She wasted no time in drumming men out of some of the most senior positions of power, instituting a quota requiring 40% of corporate board seats to be held by women. She created a new arm of the finance department devoted to gender budgeting, which is just what it sounds like, an office devoted to making sure the government doesn't spend more money on men than on women. Iceland was the first in the world into the crisis, but we could be the first out. And women have a big role to play in that, said Hella Thomasdottir, one of the founders of a female-led bank. It goes back to our Viking women. While the men were out there raping and pillaging, the women were running the show at home. The women in charge of the country convened a group of experts to get to the bottom of the financial crisis. Icelanders called it the Truth Commission. And then, in an astonishing move, they brought in a couple of female gender studies professors from the local university to assess what role gender played in the crash. And what may well have been a first in any country's history, Iceland's government actually studied whether macho posturing led to its economic meltdown. Its conclusion can be summed up in one word: yes. What's most remarkable about this wholesale transformation is that it only gained traction after that initial flush of power. Almost nothing was untouched by the new feminization. What started out as a crackdown on reckless bankers spread into every corner of the culture. In 2010, Iceland banned strip clubs. It announced a plan to crack down on hardcore internet pornography. A woman was named for the first time as the head of the Church of Iceland. And in 2010, 5 years ahead of the U.S., Iceland, which had already permitted civil unions, formally legalized gay marriage. The prime minister was among the first to wed. When I arrived in Iceland, I suspected that Iceland's situation was a fluke. I was certain it was a case in which a country gripped by mass financial madness before 2008 had traded it in for a mass hysterical compulsion to purge itself of everything manly. But as my visit wore on, I realized that this was no passing fad. Perhaps what surprised me most is that the men I met were at least as supportive of the move toward feminization as the women. Certainly for Gunnar, it was a welcome development. "Icelandic sagas are full of women," he tells me later that week, as we drive along Reykjavik's main thoroughfare. "Look at the stories about the famous Vikings who were mainly killing each other when they were sleeping, but behind those guys in the sagas were strong women. If anything, he wishes the women had gotten even further. I think it's wrong," he scowls when I mention Iceland's number one ranking in the World Economic Forum analysis. "We're a long way from equality." Momentarily distracted, he points out a beautiful home that we're passing, on a bluff overlooking the harbor. "That's where Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev first met in 1986, he tells me. "Beautiful," I murmur. "It's haunted." "What?" He turns onto a side street. "Iceland has 350,000 people, but 500,000 elves and 250,000 trolls and a million ghosts. So we are actually very crowded," he says with satisfaction. Soon, we pull up to the Kaffivagnin Cafe, a rough-hewn wharfside coffee shop. Fishing boats bob in the background and big groups of fishermen are gathered around long wooden tables. Ensconced at a corner table is fishing boat captain Arthur Boggison. He's a big, muscular man, well over 6 feet tall. He's been working on fishing boats since he was 14 years old. Except for a brief interlude as a competitive powerlifter in Dayton, Ohio, he's 60 years old now, but still looks like he could deadlift a few hundred pounds without breaking a sweat. Arthur isn't here to talk about bankers, whom he dismisses as elves because being an elf in general language is being kind of stupid. Nor is he interested in opining about fishing. He wants to discuss, instead, the gender wage gap. In Iceland, it hovers at around 18%, similar to the gap in the U.S. "I have never been able to understand this, and find it still so stupid that I lack words," he says. "I have a big problem understanding why women who work the same job as men don't get the same salaries. I support gender equality with all of my heart." As he speaks, I'm starting to understand a singular aspect of Icelandic culture, and in particular, of Icelandic men. Almost every man I meet shares the same view. It doesn't matter what some pencil pushers at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland say about Iceland being number one in gender equality. Iceland is still not remotely equal enough for women. The men are as fervent believers in this narrative as the women. As it happens, my visit coincides with a conference marking 100 years of the women's right to vote, granted in 1915, For those keeping score at home, that's 5 years ahead of the U.S. The conference is held at the magnificent new Harpa Concert Hall, a boom-era monument to excess. It's a slightly ridiculous modernist class prism concoction commissioned by one of the banking moguls, designed by a famous Icelandic artist, and left half-built after the crash, when taxpayers were stuck with the bill to finish it. The women I meet at the conference, like the men I've been speaking with all week, aren't satisfied with the progress Iceland has made on gender equality either. They note bitterly that the first female prime minister has already been voted out of office. Her successor, not long after our visit, will be forced to resign in a financial scandal. The anti-pornography laws have been hard to enforce and widely derided. A Vice article labeled the country's anti-porn efforts asinine. The government is again run by men. Yet the conference also gives me some insights into how, despite it all, Iceland still trumps other countries when it comes to women's equality. In part, it's a reflection of the famed egalitarian streak that all Nordic countries share. The social distinctions we're accustomed to in the U.S. you're unlikely to find an American CEO and his auto mechanic at the same dinner party, don't resonate here. Instead, fishermen fraternize easily with financiers. As if to prove the point, during a break at the conference over coffee and pastries, I recognize an older woman with short blonde hair and flats, clutching her purse and making small talk in the lobby. It's former president, Vigdis Finnbogadottir. No VIP rooms or bodyguards or roped-off areas for her. Indeed, that evening, I'm one of the several dozen conference attendees invited to a reception at the current president's house, Iceland's equivalent of the White House. I'm surprised and delighted, and also concerned about getting my papers in order for the inevitable background check. I know that in the U.S., a White House visit means running a gauntlet of Secret Service checks, cement barriers, metal detectors, and bomb-sniffing dogs. But this is Iceland. Nobody asks for my papers. And instead of a phalanx of security, we pull up in a bus to a charming former schoolhouse. Sitting aside a public jogging path, we walk through the unlocked front door, hang up our coats, and are greeted by a man who turns out to be the president himself, Olafur Ragnar Grimson. The Icelanders expect as much. On any given day, they might see him standing behind them in line at the grocery store. Iceland is Bloomington, Indiana as a nation, is how a friend describes it. At the president's house, I have a chance to meet Vigdis, who is funny and profane and reminds me about the long history of strong women in Iceland. On October 24, 1975, almost 40 years to the day of my visit, the women of Iceland famously went on strike. They poured into the street, abandoning jobs, refusing to cook or clean or look after children at home, virtually paralyzing the entire country. Banks and factories, fisheries, schools, and shops had to close. Men brought their children to work, armed with candy to keep the kids quiet. It didn't always work. Radio announcers were drowned out by the sound of children playing in the studios. The country's economy was brought to a halt. The protest became known as Women's Day Off, and it changed the political dynamic in the country for good. Within 5 years, Icelanders had elected Vigdis, back then a popular theater director, as Iceland's president, a largely ceremonial post, but nevertheless, she was the first elected female head of state in the world. During the race, a male opponent had derided her as half a woman because she is a breast cancer survivor. The night she won, she shot back, "Well, I'm actually not going to breastfeed the Icelandic nation. I'm going to lead it." And the gains for women continued. In 2000, the country introduced one of the most liberal parental leave policies on the planet, a government-funded paid leave of 9 months, including 3 months for the mother, 3 for the father, and 3 more for whichever parent chooses to use them. Daycare is heavily subsidized by the government. Not long after my visit, a female member of parliament made history by breastfeeding her 6-week-old baby while making a speech to the assembly. None of which stops Icelanders from complaining. As I grab for a kleiner, a traditional Icelandic confection that tastes like a Krispy Kreme donut, to which I have quickly become addicted, I meet a fellow conference participant, an energetic, fashionably dressed woman named Sigradur Einarsdóttir. She is an Icelandair pilot, a 3-decade veteran of the airline, and the highest-ranking female pilot in the company. She helmed the first all-female crew in the airline's history in 1996, yet she's discouraged. When I look back, I find so little has changed. Still, mostly men are in all manager positions. Another guest, a gregarious woman named Katrin Anna Gudmundsdottir, joins us. Katrin, a one-time spokeswoman for the Feminist Association of Iceland, ran Iceland's gender budgeting department, which meant she spent her days ensuring that state budget allocations didn't favor men while discriminating against women. Iceland is not a female world. We are still a male-centric world, she says. She scoffs at the World Economic Forum ranking too. Just because we're number one, it just says that the status of gender equality is really bad in the world. It's a testament to how far we still have to go. I'm puzzled by the contradictions. Iceland is supposed to be the best place in the world to be a woman. Women have achieved great power, and once even commandeered the entire government. And yet everyone I meet, men as well as women, is dissatisfied. Nobody believes that in Iceland the genders are truly equal. The most common adjective I have heard on my trip is stupid. The next day will be my last in Iceland. After packing my bags, I head down to the lobby for one last outing with Gunnar. Since losing everything in the crash, he is again stringing together jobs to make a living. He's a tour guide as well as a theater director, political activist, and my translator throughout my visit. Now he has one more friend he'd like me to meet. We drive to the outskirts of town, to a building that looks like a sad old California strip mall. Inside, up a flight of stairs, we stop in to see Gudmundur Gunnarsson, a burly, bearded electrician who until recently ran the Icelandic Electricians Union. He tells me that after the crash, half of his union members went bankrupt. Many lost their homes. They subsisted on cheap blood sausage made from sheep intestines. They were disgusted by the boom-era government, our president and the Icelandic Vikings that were talking down to the other nations. When it all came crashing down, he adds, many people said maybe we should let the women be more active in how we control the Icelandic economy. That's when it clicks for me. Suddenly it all makes sense. I notice something else about Icelandic men. For all their macho posturing, they are remarkably comfortable talking about gender in a way that American men aren't. In the U.S., if you utter the phrase gender equality, you can practically see men physically recoiling, shrinking into a defensive crouch. Not so in Iceland, where the women in Parliament once performed the vagina monologues, and even Iceland's President Grimsson, the great promoter of the business Vikings, responded by declaring himself a vagina warrior. Now in his office, overlooking the water, Gudmundur, a solidly built man in blue jeans, doesn't blink when I press him on the subject of women. It's no problem for me to say I'm a feminist, he says easily, in his deep, booming voice. He brought up his own six children to be feminists too, he says. He taught his four daughters that if they don't like what the male is saying, they just get up and say, I'm not going to listen to that guy. That's the difference between Icelandic women and American women, he insists. He has a daughter who lives in the U.S., he explains, and when he visits her there, it drives both of them nuts. American women are likely to sit there and listen to the crap the male is talking about. It's hard to imagine a similar conversation playing out with an electrician or almost any other man in the U.S. On the other hand, I should know by now that Iceland isn't like anywhere else. This being Iceland, Gudmundur's daughter, the one who lives in America, is better known to the rest of us as the singer Björk. My visit now coming to a close, I think I finally understand why Iceland truly is so hospitable to women, even though Icelanders themselves insist it isn't. The reason this country ranks number one for gender equality doesn't, it seems, have much to do with the women at all. It's all about the men. The men are agitating on behalf of the women. The men are as frustrated with inequality as their wives and daughters. The men and women of Iceland are in this struggle together. I think back to something Arthur Bogason, the muscle-bound fishing boat captain and former powerlifter, had said the day before. Why is it that it's so easy for you to talk about women's issues? I had to ask him. And how should we women engage men in this conversation about gender? Men seem so defensive if we bring it up, as if we're haranguing them, accusing them of something awful. He had stroked his stubble for a moment, looked me square in the face, and then given me some advice to pass along to American men. I would ask them if the world would end if they get yelled at. So what? Take the goddamn conversation. It's based on fear and ignorance, he says, of American men's unease. But the conversation is necessary. It will eventually happen. The sooner they take the step, the better.